Hello and welcome to the Leadership in Insurance podcast. This is the podcast where we discuss what leadership looks like in the modern insurance business. We talk to insurtech leaders and founders, innovators and change agents from the insurance industry. We also talk to thought leaders from outside the industry, such as organizational psychologists, performance coaches, and investment professionals. Anyone who can add value to the conversation on how to lead insurance businesses of the future. Good morning and welcome to the Leadership in Insurance podcast. I'm your host, Alex Bond, and I'm very lucky today to be joined by David George of BICMO. David, good morning. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks. It's a Friday. The weekend is upon us, so feeling good.
Yeah, and it's pretty glorious out there today as well, which to give people context, we are recording this in February, which hasn't been brilliant. So it's not a great day to be inside, so I'm sorry I'm keeping you on the... keeping you inside.
It's fine. It was an office day anyway, so it's a good, it's nice to have a break from regular work to have a chat with you. So
yeah, perfect. Well, look, for the folks that don't know at home, it'd be lovely if you could give us sort of a quick overview of the BICMO business and what it is you guys do.
Yeah, sure. So my name is David George. I'm the founder and CEO at BICMO. We are a niche cycle insurance specialist, and our mission is to protect the world's cyclists, protect the world's riders, who you've probably seen more in your streets during lockdown. Mm-hmm. It's surprisingly one of the industries that's done well during the pandemic. And so we're a team of, I think, 32 people now. We're based in UK and Austria and Innsbruck, where I'm based at the moment. And we set out to really keep protect riders, enable them to do more riding, and inspire them to get out there and explore the world on two wheels. So we have our direct business that we through the website that you see, but we also work very closely with large partners within the cycling space, right through from governing bodies such as British Cycling through to Brompton Cycle Scheme, Bike Register, and quite a few others sort of coming up in the German and Austrian markets as well. We are a team of bike geeks. Everyone on the team rides to a certain degree, which really helps the experience that we can give to the end consumer, right through from a national champion, Keith, our head of customer experience in the UK market, through to people who commute to work every day. But it's a broad range, but it gives us a good sort of understanding and belief behind the sector. And from a tech standpoint, we build all the technology that enables someone to purchase a policy, view information, and make midterm adjustments claims. And we believe that technology aspect is a really important part of managing that whole kind of customer life cycle and really giving them the protection they need to carry on riding.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks, David. I'm sort of intrigued about the bike geek thing. Is there, because it's a bike geek thing, is there a bike geek hierarchy between like the commuter and the, is there some biking bullying between like mountain biking and like a cycle cross and whatever?
Interesting. I mean, the split has changed a bit from road to mountain bike as we kind of grew up around the Innsbruck area, which is surrounded by mountains, and most people kind of ski, snowboard in the winter, and a mountain bike largely in the summer. There are road cyclists on it, and then it's more sort of on the road sort of angle in the UK market. But it's quite a broad range. When we're talking team wise, there is a little bit of a split. The engineering team, George, our CTO, is definitely a massive mountain biker. The others do a bit, but a bit less. But when we're talking about customer experience, people who pick up the phone, speak to cyclists every day, put them back on the bikes, they are the bike geeks. They know technically and just the sport, the culture, so they can speak to you as a rider. Again, a really important part. And then the other team, the bigger team for cycling, is really the partnerships team. So the people who interact with the bigger partners, the brands, the retailers, the publishers, you know, and they need to speak to people on the same sort of level. We don't go in with white shirts and, you know, the latest tie at all. We kind of speak to them on their level. I think that's really why, through not approaching it as like a hard sales sort of insurance perspective, which is why we've managed to build and retain such a great partner network.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, like cycling, because I think there was this massive explosion, particularly in the UK, wasn't there? And I think it was off the back of all the Olympic success in cycling, and then people sort of started to get back into it. And I know sort of the cost of the average bike, I mean, you will know this data better than I, but it must have gone up quite dramatically as well.
And in lockdown, it's gone up even further because you cannot buy a bike for love nor money if you try.
No, you can't. There's been some interesting, trends. So we had the sort of post 2012 up to probably 2014, 15. We had this really big boom post Olympics, the Wiggins sort of era, if you will, when we were smashing it across the world, you know, Olympics and the rest of it, and still doing really well as a nation, you know, on a cycling, from a cycling perspective. So yeah. There was that big, and it was kind of, particularly the road cycling market was starting to peak around about 2017, sort of 2018. And around that sort of time, though, the e-bike market started to come off. So the average e-bike is worth about three times the average regular bike. And that's where the biggest growth is going to come. And that's 35% of our new business now comes from e-bikes. We did some great research, reduced the pricing for e-bike riders. That was quite an interesting one. When the pandemic hit, it's been slightly different, actually, because originally our business was built for the kind of the cycling enthusiast. We definitely wanted to cover all riders, but as you know, with any sort of brand, it's good to start with a high end and then sort of, you know, work down. So the cycle schemes of the world, the bike register customers, the average bike value is lower because it's more of a utility sort of ride. The thing we've seen during the pandemic is actually the volume has grown, but actually the average bike value compared to our normal customer has come down a bit. So the average premium has come down a bit. And that's really because it's people rediscovering cycling. So they've got a bike in the garage they never knew about, but they don't want to use the bus or the train because it's too close to other people. Yeah. So there's that side of things. And there's new entrants to the market, young and old, who just thinks actually that looks like a great way to get around. And e-bikes are a really interesting part of that mix because they overcome one of the barriers to cycling, which is turning up at work being sweaty. People don't like that, as well as helmets and road safety and all this sort of stuff. You know, we're in a great place with the pandemic, with the investment into cycling infrastructure. But it's been interesting. It's been a shift in demographic. The bike value's sort of changed a little bit. But like you say, I mean, unfortunately, the bike industry was caught unaware by the boom. And they have like a 5 or 6 month cycle from manufacture to sale. So we already know from Trek, one of the biggest manufacturers in the world, they've sold all the 21 stock already.
Wow.
You know, it is crazy. So I think that's going to lead to a shift in the bike industry, possibly to shorten lead times so they can respond to these sort of waves in demand. But we see the boom continuing for 21, probably into 22 as well, and then an e-bike being a bigger mix of that.
Yeah, because e-bikes are sort of now fairly ubiquitous, aren't they? And they sort of very much weren't the case. And my dad bought one in lockdown, and I think that's the one thing that you and I touched on when we spoke before, is just the value of bikes have gone up quite dramatically. And I know you were saying it's actually gone down on an average because of people sort of, for various reasons. But I think people that bought bikes and were into biking before this year, people were happier to commit to a larger number. And it only struck me when we were talking, I think I mentioned that I had never thought of insuring my bike, which is madness, because other than outside of my laptop and probably a watch, like, my bike's probably the most expensive thing I own, and I've never thought about insuring it at all. Am I quite common, or am I just a bit slow on the uptake?
No, very, very. It's a commonly, absolutely. You're on par with a lot of the world, I guess. To an average punter, and I guess probably before I got into the insurance game, because that's not my background, you look towards maybe an extension of your home insurance policy. And there used to be some really good policies. Marks and Spencer used to have a great limit and not much extra. But it's our biggest challenge is really the home insurance versus cycling insurance. It's really the education piece, letting people know it's there. If you've got a low value bike, a few £100, it's just a commuter, you're just doing it soon from work, probably not the right thing for you necessarily. You can probably cover it under your home insurance, but the likelihood that you're going to claim on your bike insurance is far higher than your home insurance. And when you claim for your home insurance, you have an excess, and then it does go on a register, so you might have a change in your premium from one year to the next. So sometimes it's good to keep them separate for that reason. But also, there's a lot of restrictions with a lot of home insurance policies. So if you've got a very expensive bike, it probably won't be covered under your home insurance. Check the small print, have a chat with them and see what's out there in the market, I think, in the cycling the cycling market. But there's also a lot of exclusions. If you're looking to even do a sportive, if the bike's in your car, it might not be covered. If it's away from the house, it might not be covered. And you know, it has changed a little bit, but it's still around, I think around about 85% of our claims are away from the house. And half of them are actually accidental damage. It used to be higher, but it's changed in the past year. So you might think, everyone thinks about the bike being stolen. That's the biggest risk, isn't it? You know, you come out, you lock it up safely in the right sort of way outside, and you come out back out after work or from the garage at home, and your bike's been nicked. So that's a total loss. But more than you know, our biggest reason for claim is accidental damage. So people riding into a pothole, you might be doored by another car. It might not be your fault.
Mm-hmm.
But that could happen. You're on an icy road, a slippery road. You're riding with other friends. One friend goes down, you know, takes you down, and the cost of that sort of incident can be as high mm-hmm. as a regular one. Actually, just to add in, without making it too long, the other bit is you often wear, particularly if you're wearing RAFA, some nice POC or CASC or whatever headgear, you can wear as much as your bike costs, and a lot of home insurances don't cover that. So we do that standard, you know. So if you slide down the road, your shoes might be £200-300. Your mm-hmm. You know, bib shorts, Asos bib shorts or RAFA ones, you know, you can take a lot out. So it kind of covers all of those things to get you back on the ride with as minimal financial loss as possible, so you can get back out riding. And that's really it's the purpose of any niche insurance, to sort mm-hmm. of like to meet the need of a specific market. And that's mm-hmm. that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that highlights the kind of benefit of kind of niche understanding. And also, you know, what I wanted to bring it back to, and I think this touches on, you know, your route into this business. You're not from the insurance world. You're an engineer by trade, weren't you previously? Is that right?
Yeah, I studied engineering, and I went into the nuclear decommissioning and sort of oil and gas sort of field, sort of taking apart all the old sort of crap, if you will, from the sort of 60s and 70s, robotics and electronics and that side of things. But I grew up in the Lake District, I've always ridden bikes, and I, to be honest, as much as engineering was there, it was never really my passion. I think it's a great sector, good knowledge for understanding how the world is put together and how stuff is manufactured and so forth. It's phenomenal sort of background for that. But I always wanted to start a business, and the original business that I launched back in 2011 was actually a comparison business. So the aim behind it was to build use technology to build a service in a sector that I loved, which i.e. cycling, that enabled people to spend more time riding. And the first iteration of that was a comparison engine. So really simple terms, you're looking for a component or a bike, we can tell you where to buy it online for the best price, or locally for a good price as well. So we always tied in local retailers, which has become an important part of our ongoing business. But we added a bit more intelligence that said, if you tell us what bike you've got, we'll tell you which bits fitted it. So it used a bit of engineering logic behind that to say, you know, this frame will fit this headset, or even something as simple as tires, the right tire size width for your bike. Cut a long story short, we had some really good success. We were getting some good traffic, had some great partnerships. The commercial model was completely flawed, and it was on the business plan from day one to work with the insurance sector in enhancing their service to riders. So we had a chat with from Hiscox, who I spoke with, and he said, we can give a better service for your customers who have bikes. And he said, well, why don't you do an insurance policy? Spent a lot of time having a look at forums and social media, what the pain points were, having a look at the existing market, really clunky old ones. It was always big insurers or big brokers that did cycling as a really small part. And there was such a big gap to do things so much better that the opportunity was a no-brainer to go for it. So we built the original platform in 10 weeks, launched just after the Tour de France in 2014. We went to a RAFA event, we sold coffee, we got 2,000 email signatures, and we were selling policies from day one. So it was an interesting one, but I think actually the background in being in the bike market, understanding riders, the retail distribution, manufacturers market, how all that worked really contributed towards our success from when we moved into insurance.
Well, particularly when you're doing like such a full service offering that you've got, you know, you need to know the parts and the manufacturers, and you basically need to know the network of how that goes together. It's not as simple as you almost need to build it from that way around rather than going from the insurance point down, because the insurance part is arguably relatively simple. It's about getting people back on their wheels and moving as quickly as possible. And to do that, you know, you need to know the infrastructure of bikes and cycling rather than the other way around, I would say.
Yeah, 100%. Like, if you look at the experience a consumer has, they're really going to give you money on the basis that in the future, if I have an accident, you're going to sort me out and put me back where I want to. And this is where I had a chat this morning about technology and technology being an enabler to enable that to happen, but not the solution or the experience in its own right. And also, actually, if you think about the experience, when we looked at the market, quite a lot of people either got cash in your account, but it was massively reduced if you had an older bike, big excesses, or in a lot of cases you got vouchers for Halfords. Now Halfords is a good brand, and they do stuff. A lot of people get the first bike from Halfords, but if you've got a specialist bike, you do not want vouchers to go to Halfords, you know, and actually and just get something which fits within their remit. You really want something different. So rather than taking that approach, we work with independent retailers across all our territories, because a retailer is a really important part of the local cycling community. They can provide a better service to our customers than we could on the ground in person, talk them through what they might be looking for. And from our perspective, it also helps with fraud prevention, because if you're trying to defraud an insurance company, you want cash. So it feeds a lot of different things. But yeah, it's really about supporting the cycling community as well as getting that person back riding.
Brilliant. I think on that vein, you know, what I love is that you've started a business that's your passion, and that's a great thing. I don't think enough people get the opportunity to do that. I think there's a lot of people that make their business their passion because, you know, if you sort of commit a load of time and energy to something, but it's lovely to see it being done the other way around. I don't get me wrong. I'm sure at times during the business inception and doing it, there's probably you want to throw a few bikes off against the wall, but it's nice. It's that way around. And I wanted to talk to you about values, and we talked about this previously. Because you guys are a B Corp, aren't you? You're a registered B Corp. What has that meant to your business in terms of, well, I suppose, did you start with, we're going to be a B Corp, right, when you started the business? Was that something you thought about straight away?
No, not specifically B Corp. I mean, I think B Corp's kind of a framework, if you will, for sort of getting yourself to a particular level, and it's becoming increasingly well known as a brand now. BrewDog just certified the other day, so I've no doubt that's going to have a positive sort of impact on the B Corp sort of brand and operations. But no, I think. I mean, you talk about like in the previous bit about the aches and pains of growing a business, you know, and every entrepreneur, everyone starting a business is going to go through a lot of journeys, a lot of like higher highs than you would ever have from a normal job, but so many lower lows as well. And you need to kind of have that resilience moving forward. And I guess like harking back to what I said before, the aim behind the business was really to provide a service that enables people to do more of what they love. And I think sort of sitting behind that, you know, everyone starts a business for a reason, some purely financial. And I think from my perspective, it's having like a level of purpose and actually wanting to make a small dent on the world. And I think my contribution towards improving the world I live in, and particularly having kids now, you want that to be the case, that they're inheriting a better place than you were kind of born into, or you will when you move on. And I think the culture and the ethics were there from day one. And B Corp was a really great process of kind of formalizing that in a way. And we started the process in 2016. It took a couple of years, and we were certified in 2019. And it's quite a rigorous process about going through and analysing every aspect of your sort of business. And I guess for those people who are less familiar with it, I think the core thing for me is it's not just about lowering your carbon footprint. It's about changing the balance of you not being there as a company purely to make profit for return for your shareholders. They're very much the Milton Friedman, doctrine, that side of things. That's all a company exists for, to make money for shareholders. And actually changing that and flipping it and saying, well, actually we're here to support society, and that includes your team and the communities around you. It includes your impact as a business. So yeah, actually what you do as a business, is it harming the environment or these sort of things? Becoming a B Corp is not just about us as a business reducing our sort of carbon footprint per se. It's actually really challenging why and how you operate as a business, and moving it away from, we're not just here to make a return for shareholders, you know, the Milton Friedman doctrine of old, but it's actually changing that sort of balance and flipping it to say we're actually here to looking at wider stakeholders. So society in general, that includes the team that you work with, the team and your community around you. It means environmental factors and your impact as a business on the environment within your sort of supply, your value chain, all that sort of stuff, and really analyzing all those sort of things. And we after going through the process, the thing that was most impressive for me was how much the team bought into this being something that we stand for. And I think you know, we've always had a really great team, but we've put even more focus into, and particularly during lockdown, you know, when there's been a lot of challenges with different people through, either childcare or illnesses, like working alone in long stints, and really putting a lot of focus onto the team and support and kind of culture. And also, yeah, analysing what we do as a business, looking at all our impacts and so forth. And the outcome from that has been, I guess, a much an even more engaged team, an even stronger culture. And people have joined the business specifically because we're a B Corp. And I don't just mean like entry-level positions. I mean senior-level positions that are coming in with skills and experience and expertise and want to shift out of just that normal rat race and actually work for a purpose-led business. And I do think that we're going to see a lot more of that, particularly as generation, you know, whichever Gen Z and so forth, you know, come through. I think that's going to be more important as a business to really put your values, you know, front and center.
No, I completely agree. And I, you know, I did some interesting work recently where I was, you know, a business was trying to kind of formulate the B Corp values. And I was asked to look at what it meant from a kind of recruitment standpoint and a talent and talent management point of view. And, you know, things like having really comprehensive, you know, comp and bend structure and reviewing those things. What has it meant practically in terms of, have you had to put things in place, like structurally, you know, whether it be around talent or recruitment, that particularly things that you kind of didn't necessarily come naturally, were there things that came up and you thought we haven't factored that in, and how do you practically put those things in place?
Yeah, I guess if you're particularly looking down the sort of B Corp route, the first one and the most kind of basic one, and one that actually scores a lot of points within the B Corp assessment, is having in the Articles of Association, the governing documents for your business, that you are not just there to generate revenue, return for shareholders, you're there to put these other things. So that's actually in the governing. So anyone that's then buying into your business or wants to see what you do as a business, it's kind of there in the sort of basic governing documents. So that's super important. But yeah, I mean, with the team, when you're growing a team, and you'll know this more than I do, you know, this is your profession, I think there's so many different phases which are really important. One is the recruitment phase, and actually during that sort of interview process or the selection process, letting people being clear about those values and what they're expecting, you know, not just what we do as a business, but expectations of them when they come into the business. I think it's really important. But then when someone starts, it's taken a while to really sort of nail the onboarding process, so they feel like part of the company from as early on as possible. You know, so they feel sort of bought in and bought into the business, where we're going as a business. And I think the biggest thing from that is probably it has to not be about one person. I mean particularly me, it can't be just about one person within the business. A culture, you know, has to go through everyone within the business. So one of the things we did was pull together a team. There's five of us now on the sustainability team that focus on B Corp and our giving and various different aspects of the business. So I think that's a really good thing, because then people take ownership of various parts of this in the business, and then various people within the business, depending on the role or the person that's coming in, will spend a bit of time with those individuals. And particularly virtually has been a very hard thing to do, you know, onboarding someone when they're just sat in their home. But we seem to have done really well, like I think with that. And I think ongoing embedding that practically, we started bringing an ENPS, or an employee net promoter score survey that we did. And we got a score. I was really impressed. Actually, we got a score of 60, which, bearing in mind, it's minus 100 to plus 100. It's not just 0 to 100. It's a great score. And we're going to do that. We're going to run that biannually to make sure on top of it. People give an opportunity to give feedback, anonymous feedback, so they can say things. And there are, you know, we're not a perfect business. No businesses, but it gives an opportunity to get that feedback quite early on, address what's not quite right, and then have that sort of continual improvement sort of mindset.
Do you think when, as you scale, that will be harder? Does that worry you?
Yeah, I think, I've answered this question a couple of times recently. One of my biggest risks in scaling is culture and not being able to maintain that as we grow. And I think, there has to be two aspects to that. I guess the rate at growth, I don't know what the time is from when someone starts to when someone feels and could share who we are as a business and the values and everything. It's not going to be immediately. It won't be 1 or 2 weeks. It'll be a bit of time before they do that. But I think if you grow too quickly, you're probably bringing too much at one time. And that's, unfortunately, that's an issue that we will probably have. But yeah, I do see, I haven't got the perfect answer to it right now, but I do see that as being one of our kind of key challenges as we grow.
Yeah, no, that I think that's a challenge to everyone. I mean, I you know, definitely, you know, in my life, I worked for a really small recruitment business, which honestly the best job I've ever had. And then they grew so quickly that the business values kind of felt a bit lost for a period of time. And it was still a great business, but the problem you then get is that when you buy into the values as a person, if those values shift, but your values haven't shifted, then you're at odds with the business. And then, you know, I've commonly said that people actually, they don't leave jobs or companies, they leave when the values kind of become too separate from their own. And I think that's only going to become more so. I think people are, you know, look, the pandemic has done a lot. If you're working at home on your own and you're remote working now, it becomes about things like, what are the values of my companies? Like, am I doing, you know, good? Am I doing good work? You know, not in the tree hugging, you know, unnecessarily kind of puritanical version of it. Just, you know, do I feel like we're sort of putting more into the world than we're taking out? You know, and I think a lot of people look at those things. So, because I've answered more questions about those things, and I've been asked to be in more initiatives about those things than at any other point. And yeah, speaking from my own experience, I finally got off my feet to kind of try and build some not-for-profit relationships that I believe in, about, you know, that support my own values, and that's in my own one-man band recruitment business. So, do you think there's because I believe this, but I wonder what your thoughts. Is there an ROI? Is the return on investment on values? I was going to say, does there need to be? I was going to end that with, does there need to be? I suppose, but
I think in short, yes, I do think there's an ROI on values, and there has actually been some research done. I think the research was in 2018, 2019, it looked at big, against the regular businesses versus, and I'm going to use B Corp as an example, because that's where the data came from. Mm. And I think the result was, if you're looking from a purely economic perspective, I think from 2013 to 2017, B Corps had three times the amount of growth than a regular business had. I think regular business growth is 15%, it was about 49%. So if you're looking at purely a hardcore, like commercial sort of data, then yeah, it absolutely does sort of stack up. And one of the other parts of the business was that 66% of people are willing to pay more from a brand that reflects their values or has sort of sustainability embedded within them. So actually, arguably, you could charge more for your services or through you know, and again, this is a purely commercial sort of standpoint, you know, through being a business that has those values and uses them within their sort of communications with customers. I think the other side of things, I mean, the ROI has to be in retention for me, not just retention of customers. That's really important. I mean, we're an insurance business, and retention is arguably, I think, our biggest metric. You know, customer growth is great, and there's lots of other things, but retention is so important to us. But it's actually the retention of employees, and there's nothing more disruptive than not getting the right employee on, but a very valuable employee moving on. And if you're not, as you mentioned before, if your values shift, or you're not embedding your values and representing them in everything that you're doing, and that employee becomes disenfranchised with what you're doing because of that, and they move on, there's a huge impact on the team emotionally, socially, as well as the effort and cost required in getting the replacement for them. So I think from my opinion, across the board, I think there's an ROI. Some is measurable, quite clearly measurable, for the ones I mentioned before, and some is less measurable, but is very, very valuable nonetheless. So yeah, I think there has to be.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting what you're saying about employees, because it's one of the things that I kind of, obviously my world is, you know, staff turnover, and sometimes you kind of sit there objectively and go, why is the staff turnover so high? And I think people, it's great to hear you doing things like, internally looking at your net promoter score with your employees, because I think that sort of stuff is absolutely vital, because quite often where I sort of see these businesses with high turnover, anecdotally, when I sort of speak to those businesses, what I notice is there's a huge disconnect with how the business views itself and its culture and how its staff actually view its culture. Because I always say, if you want to know about your company culture, ask your staff. Don't tell me what's written on your wall in the boardroom. You know, like, these are our values. Because are they? You know, they might be, you might aspire to those values, but it doesn't mean that they are your values. And it's really important to kind of find out what they are, but you don't know unless you ask the people that work for you.
And I think you have to put yourself out there and do that continually. You should, I think, as a business, as a responsible business. Like, it's interesting how you kind of phrase that, actually. It's saying that the business views these as values. And I think what you mean by that is is the directors or the owners, ownership of the company, you know, as being the business, whereas actually the business is, it has to be an entirety of everyone within it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about technology because obviously you know, you fit in the insurtech bracket. I mean, that's a this is such a vastly wide term. It's like tech, it's a tech-enabled insurance provision, right? And I was going to ask you a little bit more about the kind of technology that you guys utilize. But the point I was actually thinking of making about insurtech, we tend to focus more on the tech bit. But you guys are very customer centric. You know, it's been built literally backwards from what do our customers need. Do you think sometimes we kind of focus too much on the tech and then we lose sight of kind of what the customer wants or customer sort of desires might be?
Yes, I think if we take this sort of technology piece before, I think when you kind of come through the startup world and particularly coming to the insurtech world, there's a lot of buzzwords around at various sort of points in time. You know, came right through from the digital wallets with GetKnip and all these sort of ones, and the sort of on-demand insurance with Trove, and then you know, blockchain and AI and all these sort of things, and then the investment industry, because you know insurtech is largely investment funded, get very excited about these different sort of pieces of technology, and actually a lot of them have fallen by the wayside because they don't necessarily represent the customer need or the customer requirement or how a customer wants to interact with an insurance product. And I think that gets lost in the sort of the excitement and the buzz, you know, around these sort of things. And I think I'm a massive fan of technology. I love technology for what it enables me to do or enables people to do in general, but it's not the end experience. It's not the end service that we're providing. We are, you know, we're here to protect against financial risk, particularly from my perspective with, you know, our customers with cyclists. And for me, the technology piece has to be an enabler. It's got to, and I think we will use new pieces of technology as they come on, but the real aim of doing that is just to make the customer interaction quicker, more satisfying, you know, to build as a brand rather than actually just focusing on the one thing itself. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that we focus on experiencing the customer, the consumer at all points, you know, touch points along the kind of value chain, if you will, from acquisition through to, you know, our cloud accounts that can do midterm adjustments, claims, right through to actually the payments sort of structure. How is someone paid at the back end? How quick can it be? And it's interesting, you know, there's been a lot of, if you look at there's no insurtech or insurance company really that has purely through the means of technology completely disrupted the market. Mm. They've done a particular point in the value chain. You know, there's Buy Miles, James Blackman and Buy Miles are doing great things within the on-demand, Buy Miles, you know, in car insurance, which has been amazing in the pandemic. But even like, you know, companies such as Lemonade, you know, they talk about, is AI Jim, I think, is their bot, and they could process a claim in X number of seconds. Well, actually, you know, I think the consumer is not going to necessarily be that fussed if it's a second faster or 10 seconds faster or even an hour faster, as long as they can trust that company, they're going to do the right thing, pay me out the right amount of time, treat me as a human being, don't just treat me as a, you know, an asset. And I think you need to look at that kind of whole piece rather than just sort of focusing on an individual piece of technology if you're really going to shape the market and change the market and do something different. Mm-hmm. That being said, I will say there are some insurance providers that are pure technology providers. They slot into one part of the value chain, and then yes, that value to an incumbent insurer, for example, is very valuable because they can reduce their loss ratio, but sorry, their expense ratio by X. Mm. But I'm kind of talking about that wider piece of having a customer centric business.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of the problems when we talk trying to lump kind of insurtechs together. It's like you've got technology solutions that serve the insurance market, and then you've kind of got what I would frame like digital enabled insurance coverage, and that could be anything from, you know, a digital MTA through to a full stack digitally native insurer, and they're not one and the same thing. You know, one might be kind of some risk analytic tool that exactly as you say plugs in, and then sure, you probably should, mind you, even then I suppose, you know, you should be customer centric. You know, what does this tech enable an individual to do? I've had a couple of people on recently talking about AI tools and machine learning, and basically that my learning on it after speaking to these experts for about 3 hours is that the whole focus should be on augmentation of like the existing skill sets, like enabling people to be able to do their jobs better and take away a lot of the stuff that machines are really good at, which is volume, monotonous tasks. And then when you put that to even taking it back to the values-led stuff that we were talking about, people don't want to do boring, repetitive tasks. And generally, we're not very good at it. You know, like admin says the man is terrible at admin, you know. It enables people to kind of be better. And then you can kind of take that. And I think one of the focuses that people tend to have is that when you talk about automation and technology, I think there's an instant leap in the head to say, right, that's going to reduce costs. And then the fear with that is if we reduce costs, then do we have to kind of reduce the price and therefore profitability of our business? Well, no, you just give yourself room to kind of create a premium product and a better experience is the way that I look at it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you can choose to do one or two things with it, can't you? I think it depends which sector you're in. If you're in the motor space where it's a zero margin game, it might mean you make the fraction of a percent of profit, which over the, you know, a lot of customers it is great. But I'm completely with you. You know, I think it depends what product they're buying and what they're expecting back from it. It is worth, I guess, sort of touching on that point that I do think where some of the disruption has happened and will continue to happen is looking at that, the value in insurance. And, you know, when it first came into the market, you know, starting from the kind of first principles perspective, out of every £100 that a customer gives me, how much is actually going back towards paying claims?
Yeah,
because that's ultimately what a business is there to do. Mm-hmm. And you very soon learn that in a lot of industries, it's very little. Some industries is single digit percentages, you know. And then you look at where's the rest of that money going to? And a lot of it is in inefficiencies with, you know, expense ratios that are put on there by consumers plus acquisition. And that acquisition can be through intermediaries, brokers such as myself, or it can be, you know, sort of direct sort of business. But I think there is always that question for me is if you operate the business as efficiently as possible, you either have the option then to provide that absolutely next level service or some other benefits that the customer was not expecting, or it allows you to be more price flexible. You know, to say actually, well, in this case, we want to give a bit of a discount. We want to work, you know, we need to be more price sensitive so we can, you know, get more of the market, for example. So I think there's a range of things. I think the more that we strip out, like you said, that manual repetitive work that customers are doing, bearing in mind customers still, a decent chunk of the time, still want to pick up the phone and speak to someone because humans are humans. You know, I think once that's sort of at a good level, then at least it gives you the options then to do what you want with the rest of that, you know, that pot out of the £100, 100% of the premium.
Mm. And it all ties in really. I mean, I think I love the way that you seem to look at insurance is one, it's an enabler and secondly, you know, it's a social good, right? It's a social, it's what it's there for. And the last thing I wanted to, because I'm conscious of your time, but the last thing I wanted to pick up with you, something that we talked about was that we're getting much, much better at identifying and understanding risk to the point where we can do it on a granular detail and we can personalize it. And obviously you're talking about kind of individuals, and it's a bit different with your business, but I just wanted to get your view on this. Maybe do you think we risk that if we individualize the kind of understanding of risk to such a granular detail, that we risk the kind of losing the law of large numbers, which applies to insurance? So therefore people become individually uninsurable, or businesses become uninsurable, and it's almost contrary to that kind of social good aspect of insurance, because you then kind of just have these people, some people can afford it and some people can't, and it just exacerbates that problem potentially.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, you really, it's a tricky topic in many ways, isn't it? But the whole purpose of insurance, regardless of the model that sits behind it, is the, you know, the premiums of the many pay for the claims of the few, and you kind of put yourself in a position as an insurer where you're not adversely selecting. So you're not just bringing those people on who are likely to claim and frequently and so forth, but at the same time, making sure that people who do actually genuinely need that cover can access it. There is a kind of moral, you know, there's a moral and kind of social aspect to that as well, which is, it's tricky, isn't it? There's no sort of formulaic sort of rules around it. I guess as a consumer, as a B2C consumer, even as B2B, you still want to buy the right cover at a reasonable price for your particular situation. Mm. If people not being able to get insured prevents them from doing business because an insurance company perceives them to be a higher risk, that's not a good thing. And there are some great things going on around the world, the kind of micro insurances in Africa to protect against crop damage and crop stuff. So I do feel like there's an area of this sort of insurance space that is kind of leaning in towards that some certain risk. that being said, there are certain risks which shouldn't be covered. You know, I think, and arguably, you know, the insurance industry for many years has been a great, advocate or force behind improving safety and, you know, lives after others. We're talking, you know, after the fire of London, you know, the fire breaks or the distance between houses. We're talking about seat belts in cars, those sort of things that really genuinely save a lot of lives and improve performance. So the question in my mind is then how can we go beyond that? What is the modern day equivalent of that? How can we do stuff? And I think, you know, the biggest one has to be insurance of companies that have a massive impact on the world. And we're talking, you know, fossil fuels, certain types of agriculture, certain areas that arguably they should, because of their impact on the world, have a higher premium for being able to transact business. And perhaps some of that premium does go towards schemes or benefit, you know, things that can benefit the wider society and the environment. So it's an interesting topic. I think that's probably one you could go deep into for a few hours with a bit more of a look. But yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, no, I was talking quite recently about we're quite good at green finance, but we haven't done a lot of green, you know, insurance initiatives yet. And you know, it's coming. It's definitely coming. But the setting up your portfolio where you don't underwrite companies that are damaging to the environment, or at least you work with them to kind of, in the same way that your point was exactly right. You know, we work with people on a health and safety standpoint to kind of help them reduce their risk and exposure. We're not doing enough of that on the kind of sustainability efforts, and we should be. And if we bring that all back to the kind of B Corp sort of values, I'll try and say that again, B Corp values. we know that if we do those things, actually, there's a return on that as well. The chances are, if you're working with a company that's prepared to work with you on sustainability issues, that's a well-run company. That's a company that's kind of looking to change, and actually that's a company you want to work with long term, because they'll probably be more profitable. Companies that are stuck in the kind of old ways of doing things, are they risks you want to take on in the long run? Yeah,
couldn't agree more.
Yeah, super. Well, Dave, I will be conscious of your time, and thank you very much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. It's great to talk about that. It's not often we get to talk about values on these things. Usually talk about insurance and just insurance. So thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, great to be on board. Look forward to hearing back.
Perfect.
As always, this podcast is brought to you by FinPro Search Partners, often simply known as FinPro. FinPro is an executive recruitment business working in the insurance and insurtech space on an international basis. If you would like to find out more about FinPro, please visit our website, www.wearefinpro.com, or our FinPro company page on LinkedIn. I've been your host, Alex Bond, and I would personally love to connect with anyone who is interested in the changing world of insurance. So feel free to reach out to me directly, either on LinkedIn or via my email at alex@wearefinpro.com. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and I hope to see you back next week. Thank you.